Welcome to Business Watch, where we're putting the week into perspective. Three major global problems have dominated headlines and weighed on markets this week. First, supply chain snarls are straining everything from USPS delivery to grape nuts availability around the world. Second, a chip shortage is slowing production of trucks, gaming consoles, and lots more. And third, we've seen a surge in ransomware cyber attacks disrupting a large variety of organizations, including beef suppliers and big governments around the world. Meanwhile, the IMF lowered its forecast for 2021 global economic growth this week, but raised South Africa's outlook from just over 4 to 5%. And we see the delisting deluge continuing with another two, potentially four this week. And it certainly irks me when I see global predators seeing the value of some of our once high-flying stocks and come to buy them out. So when we're not seeing the same local activity, where are our deal makers and investment bankers? Well, to put things into perspective, I'm joined by Nessa Nair, Senior Portfolio Manager at Sasfin, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mplunger, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Nessa, when it comes to chips, Japan reportedly might partner with TSMC and Sony to build a $7 billion chip factory to address the shortage. Meanwhile, we've got the White House spearheading a $52 billion US dollar bill to boost its own domestic chip-making capabilities. Sounds like a little, too late.
Yeah, it certainly does. You know, I think one of the things we kind of take for granted is that there will be, a supply of electronics. And of course, that obviously depends on, whether or not the sort of components that make up those electronics are available. Remember, it's not made in one factory, it's made in different parts of the world. And a key ingredient, to a lot of those components are those chips that you talk about. You know, the chip shortage that we're seeing globally now is obviously derived from the fact that, we're coming out of a massive slowdown in 2020, and a lot of the infrastructure sort of is still needs to get up and running, but also massive demand for these chips. There's almost 170 different industries that make use of these chips. So you can imagine, you spoke about those gaming consoles, we know electronics, but also, the vehicle industry, massive use of electronics there requiring these chips. And of course, Japan and Taiwan Semiconductor, the one you spoke about, teaming up, to build a massive factory now in Japan. And of course, in the US as well. Remember, the US has got, still has a ban on Chinese chip makers. So that's even intensified this problem, of the shortage. So the US looking to build up their own infrastructure in this regard as well.
And Isa, to bring you in, it's really a pandemic prisoner's dilemma, isn't it? Because when facing huge shared costs, individual companies often wait for someone else to pay first. But if no one pays, I think everyone loses here. So governments sometimes get involved just to spur some action. If you look at Exhibit A, climate change, without fines or rewards, companies have little financial incentives to curb pollution. Now, US President Biden is hoping that these big bucks and hefty fines are going to convince companies to tackle global economic threats together. How likely is that that he'll pull it off before Christmas?
Look, climate change is an existential crisis for the global economy. So the rich countries are likely to devote significant amount of funds to make sure that there is a just transition. We saw the last 2 weeks we had an envoy from the rich countries coming to South Africa to come and have conversations with the likes of Eskom. You know, we saw from the UK, from the EU, there are funds that are set aside to help poor countries transition. So to the extent that it is an existential crisis for the global economy, the rich countries will come to the party, and the US is expected to do so, which is unlike what we saw in the vaccine nationalism, where they have vaccines, they can safeguard their populations, and as a result, they haven't devoted as much money to help poor countries vaccinate their population, simply because it's not an existential crisis for the global economy, but for poorer countries. But with climate change, it is very different. Every country will have to do its part. And the rich countries, they have to finance the poor countries to transition properly.
Now, Raymond, looking ahead for South Africa, the IMF sees a slowdown in growth to 2.2% next year, and is even more muted about growth prospects thereafter. And it again highlighted the policy challenges and risks facing the government if it's to turn the economy around and get it onto a much higher, longer-term job-rich growth path. What do you make of this latest IMF assessment for the world economy and for South Africa?
Hi, Michael. Well, I think I share what the IMF has said. I think all of us agree more or less with those numbers, both from a global point of view, but more particularly from a South African point of view. There's good news implicit in what they've said. And I think it's, as I've said before, in this case, it's the tale of two deficits which are good news. Firstly, on the balance of payments, we are running a nice surplus. Our exports are boosted, our imports are down. Of course, there are some challenges behind that, but nonetheless, that's good news at one level. If we look at the fiscal deficit, that's also good news because thanks to the rebound in our economy, we are seeing the tax revenues looking a lot better, a much bigger margin space will be available in next month's so-called mini budget. So the big challenge is, however, what do you do with this good news, with this better cyclical news? How do you build on it? How do you best make use of it? And I think the important point now, if we look at next month at the so-called mini budget, I think the theme I also mentioned last week should be prudence with purpose. In other words, you want to be able to show that you're able to use these resources wisely that have now been accommodated. We're going to grow probably 5%, but we know that's a rebound. We know that news is not going to be repeated next year on the same scale. So how do you use this particular medium-term budget policy statement in a wise way? And I think there are two major challenges. The one is, will it still be broadly in line with what we have undertaken to do in terms of our fiscal consolidation? That'll be one important part of the message. And the second is, to the degree that you have flexibility, you have some extra resources, will they go into consumption by government or into investment by government? Mm. I think that seems to me to be the important credibility test that the new Minister of Finance will face when he assembles his medium-term budget policy statement, and what message he will be putting out to the country, to the markets, and above all, to the credit rating agencies. I'm hoping that if you get this mix right, you might persuade one or two of them to change their outlook from negative to stable. So that's the challenge that I think this better news fed into the so-called mini budget needs to deliver in the next month or so for our economy.
Well, if that were to be the outcome, either to bring you in to get the credit ratings agencies to start reversing this trend over the last decade of just downgrade to negative outlook to downgrade to another negative outlook, to actually put the handbrake on that, that would be something of a victory. But it speaks also to your column that you wrote yesterday in the Business Day, following your Twitter Spaces conversation with Songezo Zibi, the former editor of Business Day, about making policy choices that are grounded in reality, that are not grounded in temporary or cyclical windfalls such as commodity booms. What would you like to see from that mini budget to ensure that we're pulling the right policy levers to support those who've been impacted by the pandemic, to tackle our youth unemployment, but also to get that job-rich growth going?
I would like to see a continued commitment to fiscal consolidation, but also I would like to see this view that we are in a super cycle of commodities price increases. It's not correct. It's a cyclical rebound, and for some reason there are some within the policymaker space that are believing that we are in a super commodity cycle as we were in the 2000s, and that would be a policy error because they are going to push consumption-based spending policies on the back of expectations of continued performance of commodities, which might not come. And I think National Treasury needs to communicate that very carefully, but also use the extra tax revenues in a third way, in addition to what Prof. Carson just said. Reduce debt instead of spending or investing. You can just reduce debt and you open up your fiscal room for the next 10 years if you are able to reduce debt by 10 billion. which is quite important for credit rating agencies because it shows you are serious about managing your finances properly, but also you know, reinforce the structural economic reforms that are being implemented. Make sure that they can show at least the evidence of what has been done since the budget in February. And if you can demonstrate what has been done, the markets will buy some of the story of what you are likely to do going forward. But if you can't demonstrate what you have done historically, markets are not going to buy what you are going to, what you say you will do. So essentially, doing what you say you are going to do. That's how you get the credibility of the market. So far, it has not been enough. We need a lot of it.
And we could start reducing that cost of capital as well by bringing down, you know, the yield on South Africa's bonds, effectively the risk-free rate, and then you've got to add your premium for equities to get to that ultimate hurdle rate. And it's just, if you're going to be making investment decisions far too high still in the South African economy, although there are many who see a brighter outlook for South Africa's economy. And Nessun, more buyouts and potential delistings this week. And we know Australia is experiencing a listings boom at the moment. And as much as the delisting issue is out of the JSE's hands, there is a global trend towards private markets, and the JSE could do little about South Africa's economic growth. It could do things in terms of just easing the regulatory burden to be listed. What would you like to see the market do to encourage more listings, especially in the mining space?
Yeah, you know, Mike, it's interesting. I know you're talking about Long for Life. Obviously, now they've announced that they've got an offer on the table. And I think it's just it's something that we've become used to, I think, as market participants, as market commentators, people seeing tremendous value in our markets. But, you know, I think as more and more South Africans investors kind of focus offshore, invariably things get left behind. And it seems to me that a lot of these small cap and mid cap shares in particular were left behind, which has given rise to sort of the massive delisting that you're seeing on the JSE. To answer your question, you know, what's going to get the market excited going forward for the more and more companies to look to raise capital at the JSE, I think it's exactly what you spoke about just now. It's that return on capital. You know, corporate South Africa is sitting with volumes and volumes of cash with really nothing to do with it. The challenge, I think, for a lot of investors is where are those opportunities? And in a country like South Africa, sure, those opportunities exist, but they're being hamstrung by regulation, particularly in the mining industry. You know, the mining charter, which was debated for a long time, was not received well. We all know about the issue of radio spectrum now. I mean, Telkom having to go to court to fight ICASA just to leave the situation as it is at the moment, because they were able to make a lot of money in the last year. Private capital is looking for a return on a regular basis. And I think if we deregulate, if we move away, you know, from a lot of these state-funded models, try and get the private sector to fund this, because the private sector has capital which the state really doesn't have. And maybe just look for the state to help, or maybe just to earn a return through taxation and, you know, growing the pot or growing the economy, you know, as it were. I think that is what we would want to see come out in this medium-term budget policy statement by the finance minister. Initiatives that help get the private sector a lot more directly involved in building out the infrastructure.
And you mentioned regulation there. ISA, PSG CEO Piet Mouton says that red tape is hobbling deal making in the country. He pointed his finger at the government and also at the JSE and the JSE's regulations. It's sitting on a 2.6 billion rand cash pile. And he was quoted yesterday saying, "We're concerned about the ever-increasing red tape at a government level, but it's a worrying level of red tape that we now see at the JSE as well." So while we often berate the government, we've also got to have a look at our capital markets, because it looks like we can be our own worst enemy sometimes in business.
Absolutely, and the recent requirement that listed firms must disclose, you know, the bottom 5% relative to the top 5% of earners within each company, but also they must disclose the ultimate shareholders in a look-through basis it's a significant requirement that possibly is going to exert a lot of pressure. Already there is onerous requirements in terms of disclosure from listing point of view, which is quite a regulatory burden compared to other emerging markets that are attracting investment significantly. South Africa is moving in the wrong direction. But it also moves against what the finance minister had said, to say we have to reduce the cost of doing business from a regulatory red tape point of view. We have to reduce it. Now we see this requirement being published. It just means we are not actually sure what we want to do, because on the one side, we say we have to reduce the regulatory burden, and on the other side, we are introducing new requirements for companies to comply with. And it's just going to put too much pressure. That's why we've seen the number of delisting on the JSE increase over the years, and it's likely to be the case going forward because of this. And it doesn't help to attract capital from offshore investors.
The IMF has now concluded its review of its investigation into the World Bank's controversial Doing Business report. The IMF board reaffirmed its full confidence in Ms. Georgieva's leadership and her ability to continue to carry out her duties. But still, the World Bank must now restore the credibility of this still very important global survey. Now, back in 2019, President Cyril Ramaphosa pledged to increase South Africa's ranking in the survey from around 82nd place out of 190 economies to a target of rising to the top 50 within a couple of years. And Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana has also recently spoken out on this subject. But we have this example, and we mentioned it earlier, of the Draft Companies Amendments Bill released this week for comment. It firstly requires listed companies to disclose the ratio of the top paid to the bottom paid of 5% workers. And secondly, there's a requirement to identify shareholders who are true or beneficial owners in a company. Now, while these may be laudable goals, to seek in a country with high levels of inequality such as South Africa's, remedies such as these that certainly don't seem practical is questionable at best. Raymond, what do you make of these suggestions contained in the Companies Amendment Bill?
Well, I think what's important here, we must look at the bigger picture of which this is just a part. We did mention it earlier, that is the cost of regulation, the burden, especially on small business, but on all business. And I think here's a question of where, to use a phrase, you want smart tape, not red tape. And at the moment, this red tape is getting in the way of a number of things, and it's showing up in the numbers, whether it's the idle cash balances or the low investment. This is obviously one of the determining factors as to why we're not getting the level of investment even from the government. There are implementation risks that are bound up with all sorts of regulations. And the problem here is there isn't a coordinated approach. You may have one minister saying, yes, I'm going to make life easier for business. Meanwhile, down the passage, some other minister decides on something else, and it simply blocks those decisions by business. So I want to take a leap forward in two ways. There's a limit to what the Minister of Finance can do on these issues in his mini budget. Except to side with those who think that we ought to do much better in being able to lighten the whole framework of regulation in South Africa, and move to the investment conference, which the President will have again in November, and to say, yes, apart from listening to the pledges and hearing what commitments have been made and whether they've been implemented or not, I would suggest that a morning session be set aside to say, the big common factor here is uncertainty, the regulatory burden. Can we get to the nuts and bolts of government and the private sector? What are these obstacles and how can they best be resolved? Because at the moment we deal with an ad hoc, we ad hoc complain. We complain on this program, we complain in the newspaper, we complain from business. We must have a session where it matters, an investment conference, because clearly there are consequences for investment. Mm. And the second point is a much neglected instrument that needs to be revived and ought to be discussed perhaps at the conference so that all ministers know they should be marching to the same tune. The socio-economic assessment mechanism was accepted by the cabinet originally, in its original form, in 2007, with the very purpose of reducing uncertainty, that prevention would be better than cure. Because once you implement that mechanism and you test the draft law, you test a draft regulation according to certain criteria, Does it increase the red tape? Is it coordinated? Is it going to create jobs? Will it promote corruption? Whatever those criteria. That mechanism is just falling into disuse. So this company's bill has not gone through that process. So do other of these often good intentions, which take the form of draft regulations, draft laws, which create shocks for the market and simply discourage the whole investment climate. So I'd like to see, beyond what other platforms we use, that the investment conference will in particular devote time to say, because you've got both the private sector and the cabinet ministers there, the all relevant ones, and say, how do we devote a session to being able to fix this and to break this problem once and for all and begin to open up better solutions that will unlock the investment capital that wants to find new opportunities and be able to create jobs in South Africa.
I think a very good point. I just want to quote here what Busi Mavuso, the head of business Unity South Africa, or Business Leadership South Africa, I should say, was writing about this week. Looking at the ratio, in itself, it's problematic because a supermarket chain is obviously going to employ a lower paid workers than an investment bank, for example. That doesn't necessarily mean it's more or less exploitative. So the ratio itself really is pretty meaningless. What kind of consultation went into a bill that is now going to codify this into law? It really beggars belief. Now, I want to move on to the last topic for our conversation today, and the Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo issue. He's now busy compiling his report. We had the former president attacking him yesterday. He's been given a fifth extension of the State Capture Commission's mandate until the end of this year, basically to give him enough time and ample opportunity to complete the report to the president by then. And it's clearly going to be a document with potentially enormous implications for our political economy, given what's happened and given what he's uncovered about state capture and corruption. If you were looking over his shoulder, and Isaac, maybe you can kick us off here, what would you like to see him say in this report?
Look, an exposition of who did what, where, and the potential recommendation of what needs to happen from a legal point of view. So essentially holding people accountable. So what the investment environment requires is that the law takes its course. Wherever there is impropriety that has been committed, the law must bite. That can bring in some confidence that if there are business people, people in government, people in civil society that are found wanting, the law is going to bite. That provides the security that people's assets are not going to be stolen and embezzled by government people or even private sector people.
Raymond, what are some of the key things that you believe the Zondo Commission report should eventually tell us?
Well, Michael, I think apart from what ISA said, obviously we want to know what went wrong, what is the profile of what went wrong in the past, and I'm hoping that that is what he'll be able to say right at the beginning as a result of his interrogations over the past 3 years. I would say I'd like to see his findings for the future. What are the remedies and the corrective measures? Rest on four main pillars. The first is we need to overhaul our procurement policies. They need to be tightened up. There are too many loose ends there, which have led to a lot of corruption. And that's one area that I think he needs to look at. The second, there needs to be better parliamentary oversight. I think there have been gaps there. Some people have been asleep at their posts and should have asked a lot more probing questions a lot sooner. The third is there needs to be better protection for the whistleblowers. There is some legislation there, but it's clear from what I've heard from some of the other experts that there are huge gaps which need to be closed. And that perhaps Zondo could also look at. Then finally, of course, the all-seeing item is the cadre deployment by the ANC, which was raised by Zondo when he spoke to the president. I think that's another area where he will need to make some findings. But I would just end by cautioning, these will be recommendations. The impact it makes will depend on the extent to which the government accepts and implements what he says. And then we could see this becoming a real game changer on these issues for the future of South Africa.
Raymond Parsons, a professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, joining us for the Week in Perspective here on Business Watch, joined by Nesan Nair, Senior Portfolio Manager at Sasfin, and Isa Mplanga, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes.